a dictator signs a deal with the country's corporations, it becomes a friend. And when this dictator doesn't allow these corporations to do business, then it's a mortal enemy.
What people have to understand, this is an occupation of another country. Military victory does not bring about a political victory or a moral victory.
They got to know that they will be liberated and Saddam Hussein will be removed no matter how long it takes.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, March 27th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Massive explosions rocked central Baghdad late Thursday night, sending a towering plume of smoke skyward in the strongest blast felt in the city in days. Shortly after 11 p.m. in Baghdad, explosions shook the capital near the city center. Buildings close to the information ministry appeared to have been hit, sending a huge plume of smoke skyward. With Iraqi troops dug in around Baghdad, President Bush pledged today to battle Saddam Hussein's forces, quote, however long it takes to win, unquote. Bush and British war ally Tony Blair said the UN should help rebuild Iraq later, though an exact role was left uncertain. The prime minister, standing alongside Bush at the president's mountaintop retreat, declared in words similar to Bush's that Saddam Hussein and his hateful regime will be removed from power, unquote. The two discussed a timetable for the war with Iraq. Bush dismissed questions that the U.S.-led invasion may take longer than expected.
Mr. President, can you help me understand the timing of this war? You talked yesterday that it'll be, we're far from over. Today you said it's going slowly but surely. We're working our way to our end goal. Given that the resistance is as strong as it's been in the South, and that we have what you call the most hardened, most desperate forces still around Baghdad, are we to assume that this is going to last, could last months and not weeks and not days?
I'll answer that question very quickly and you can get to yours. However long it takes to win, however long it takes to achieve our objective. And that's important for you to know, the American people to know, our allies to know, and the Iraqi people to know. However long it takes, that's the answer to your question, and that's what you got to know.
It's
a matter of timetable, it's a matter of victory. And the Iraqi people have got to know that, see? They got to know that they will be liberated, and Saddam Hussein will be removed no matter how long it takes.
President Bush speaking at his mountain retreat, Camp David. At the United Nations today, members of the non-aligned nations gathered in an emergency meeting to voice concerns over the attack on Iraq. The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. walked out of the hearings after Iraq's ambassador accused the United States of trying to exterminate the Iraqi people. He said, quote, I did sit through quite a long part of what he had to say, but I heard enough. U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte. Pacifica Radio's carried the hearings live, anchored by national correspondent Larry Bensky. Peace Watch spoke with Bensky later for analysis.
Well, Verna, the United Nations Security Council had an open meeting, which meant that all the 192 members of the United Nations General Assembly could address it on the question of what's going on in Iraq. And in fact, about 75 members did do so, including all 15 members of the Security Council. There was no real action item here, although underlying this is the urgency of humanitarian aid to the people of Iraq in the wake of the United States attack and invasion. And the positions of most of the people who spoke, of most of the countries who spoke, were pretty much predictable. However, there was a universal concern, even from the few countries that support the United States invasion of Iraq, about the condition of the people in Iraq. 27 million people in that country, which was economically pretty marginal to begin with. Now, with the predictable effects of what the United States is doing, having in fact been predicted by various UN and international organizations months ago, the effect on the food supply, the water supply, etc., there is grave concern that hundreds of thousands of people may be in serious difficulty before too long if they aren't already. There was definitely a sense of passion, especially on the part of the Iraqi ambassador to the United Nations, who pointed out that the United States had no evidence of weapons of mass destruction or of evil intentions, immediate intentions by the Saddam Hussein regime to attack anybody, and was therefore doing this on its own dime, as it were. But the sense of urgency definitely underlies what's going on there right now. They're haggling over diplomatic language behind the scenes, which would, on the one hand, allow the United States to be described as an occupying power, which, of course, the United States doesn't want to be, or be described as the authority and control, which is what the United States wouldn't mind being. On such niceties, tens of thousands of people's fate may depend. We're going to have to wait and see what the United Nations feels that it can do. Clearly, there's a sense of demoralization in the United Nations, having not been able to stop the United States from undertaking this attack. The United States was not able to get the 9 votes it needed in the Security Council. In fact, it never got to more than 4 out of 15. Nevertheless, the United States has gone ahead and done what it is now doing with horrific consequences on the people of Iraq. The other issue here is whether or not the Security Council will be overridden by the General Assembly, and there's a provision for that to happen, but you need 97 countries to sign on out of 192. Then you need a 2/3 vote. There is evidence that behind the scenes the United States is twisting arms, as it has throughout, trying to get the countries to not petition the General Assembly to undertake any kind of measure here. But even if they did do so, why would the United States listen to them? The United States government has proven that it's going to do what it wants to do, no matter what the UN says. And so there's a kind of a really surreal aspect to any conversations going on in the UN. But that doesn't mean there isn't genuine concern and genuine emotion being expressed on the part of the overwhelming number of nations in the world, despite what the Bush administration calls its coalition, that the United States has very little support for what's going on. And as this continues to go on and the people of the world who don't watch United States media but watch the rest of the world media learn about it, the pressure on the United States from all around the world can only be greater. Whether or not this can be effectively expressed through the United Nations is very difficult to predict at this time.
Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Binsky. Iraqi ambassador to the UN, Al Dori, said the United States had even planned the carving up of Iraq before Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. Almost sputtering, he said, the United States now was using the issue of humanitarian aid to hide its criminal aggression. Peggy Gish is a 60-year-old farmer and conflict manager consultant from Athens, Ohio. She's a member of the humanitarian group, the Iraq Peace Team. She's living in Baghdad now through the bombing in order to serve as a witness for the Iraqi people. Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian spoke with her earlier this week about conditions on the ground.
Yes, we've been walking around during the day. There are a few people out and about. It's still, most of the shops are closed, but you can still find, you know, a food or fruit and vegetable stand open here and there. So you can, in a bread store, you can get your basic needs, you know, met just down the street as far as shopping. But, you know, people are, some taxis are going, some cars are traveling, but people are very cautious and most people are staying very close to home. We haven't gone out yet this morning, but last night in the night we heard probably the longest and loudest bombing close to us, as we have the whole four or five days that the bombing has been going on. So we were real concerned about that, and yet by the middle of the night the bombing slowed down again and it was peaceful. We had the rest of the night, it was very peaceful. So we were thankful for that. Yesterday, as we were traveling, we saw a lot of buildings that were damaged by the bombs. Some were still smoking from fires. Others had already been extinguished, you know, in the last few days. We've heard from other people in our group had gone to visit us a home in which 3 women, just in the residential home, the house was bombed and 3 women were killed. We may be going out to see that place today, you know, just to see it with our own eyes, but we haven't. Some others in our group have. people know that there are a lot of civilian casualties. We've heard that there are 80, at least 80, maybe probably more by today, by this morning, of civilians killed in Iraq and over 270 injured. We've also gone to one of the trauma hospitals where we came into the wards and saw firsthand. There were some very serious ones, like a five-year-old girl who had very severe spinal injuries, and a 12-year-old boy who had a hole in his abdomen from shrapnel, and we could see his guts, coming out from that hole, and he was awaiting surgery. So there have been some, we've seen some of these casualties ourselves, and then there were many others who were in pain and awaiting surgery. So we know that there are many civilians who are being victims of bombing. It isn't just presidential palaces and government buildings, though we have seen some of them which have been bombed.
Overall, from your assessment looking around the city, does it look as though the bombing was targeted, or what kinds of sites were bombed overall?
We saw many sites that were targeted, and yet these other sites, these homes, there was a crater in a residential neighborhood that others in our group, I did not see it, but others in our group, many others in our group witnessed.
Peggy Gish of Voices in the Wilderness speaking with Peace Watch producer Scott Gurian from Baghdad. For several days now, the U.S. and British media have reported conflicting stories of uprisings in the town of Basra, Iraq. Independent journalist Lamis Adoni has been reporting on the Middle East and monitoring Arab language media for more than two decades. Adoni joined Peace Watch yesterday to shed light on reports coming out of Iraq from independent sources and to respond to allegations that Iraqi civilians are turning guns on each other. Adoni has a relative in Basra who says the water treatment facility has been bombed, but there are no uprisings in the streets. In part two, Adoni offers insight into why U.S. and British troops continue to come under fire from civilians in southern Iraq.
I think many people don't understand the situation there. There's an invasion, and people are armed, and they take up arms, and there's a guerrilla warfare going on. It's not like they met and decided this is what to do. It's like any history of an invasion of any country. People take up arms and start resisting. It has nothing to do with how they feel about Saddam Hussein. From reports I've seen from the opposition that's based in Damascus, which is the leftist opposition that was forced to leave Iraq in 79, people forget that there was an opposition to Saddam Hussein long before it became fashionable for the U.S. to talk and to prop up its own financed and backed opposition.
Mm-hmm.
They declared that they're against the invasion, and they said that some of them are going back to defend Iraq. It's the same reports from Amman indicate that, and I talked to a member of another opposition group in exile in London, because the confusion comes from the fact that all of the focus was on the so-called opposition that met in London that was backed by the U.S. But the opposition that has been historically there did not, many of them did not take part in the London meeting. A Dawa party did not take part in the meeting. Mm-hmm. The leftists did not take part in the meeting in London, and they opposed it.
So this meeting in London was of Iraqis that supposedly are supporting the U.S.?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And even that group, and I saw interviews with them yesterday, from Erbil, from the Kurdistan, are saying that we are being sidelined, that the U.S. is doing whatever it wants, we have no say in what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And another group has also declared that we supported the war, thinking that the U.S. would spare the cities. But now they are shelling the cities. We cannot support that. So there are two things here. One is that a lot of the Iraq opposition, did not support the invasion in the first place. The other part of the opposition, which supported the U.S. war, is now, some of them are now having second thoughts about the way the war is conducted.
So support is waning among Iraqis that was there to begin with. Let me ask you this, Lamise. What about the civilian casualties? We're hearing that, we've gotten to some independent reporters inside the cities who have told us about civilian casualties, and we see some civilian casualties being reported here in the U.S. by the mainstream media. But what can you tell us about that? And also, I'm curious about the fact that they're saying that some of the Iraqi soldiers are appearing in civilian clothing and ambushing or tricking the U.S. military.
Well, first of all, as you know, that the only Western media that's there is either embedded or the ones that are in Iraq, in Baghdad. And Baghdad, although it has received a lot of shelling, but today, actually, there were civilian casualties in Baghdad. I just saw them on all Arabic stations.
Are there any instances of deliberate civilian casualties that you know of on the part of the U.S. troops?
In Basra, the people there claim or say that it's deliberate because that area where it was shelled, there are no signs of any military installations. And secondly, people are mostly worried about what's happening in Nasiriyah and Najaf, and even we don't know what happened really in Emel Kasser, because they reported, even the allies have acknowledged that they were shelling these towns. So we don't know how many casualties are in these towns. And what do you mean by deliberate or not deliberate? I mean, when you shell a town, how precise can you be? They're using these big missiles and bombs. So we don't how even if they're accurate, they have a big radius and it affects all of the neighborhood. When I covered the war in Baghdad, there were instances when we saw shelling of civilian areas to break the morale of the people. So the allies don't have a record of avoiding civilian casualties. I think that in Baghdad they are trying, basically because they want to be welcome. They want to be welcomed by the people. But as they are faced with fierce resistance, I think that they are losing their temper, and they are shelling the cities. The other thing about troops disguised in civilians, the report we're receiving is that civilians are taking part in the resistance, first of all. And secondly, why is the U.S. crying foul? I don't understand it. It invades a country, and they want everybody to play by which rules? This is a war that has not been sanctioned by the world community. It's considered illegal. Secondly, We just saw on American television, in Fox News, just an hour ago, pictures of special forces disguised as Arabs. So the Americans are doing it. Why? And it's. I think in this country the problem is that there is no history and understanding of resistance of occupation. In Europe, that's a different case. This is what's happening. Is not that surprising. At all. I mean, not to us at all, because the U.S. government has reduced the whole issue to Saddam. There's a fixation on Saddam. There's no fixation on Saddam in the Arab world.
Let me ask you this. Now, if as you say, many civilians have taken part in the resistance and are, in fact, armed and shooting back, how then can the U.S. military be expected to honor the fact that, you know, that civilian, how can they honor civilians?
But this is what I'm saying. The war, this is the discourse is distorted. When there's an invading army, according to international law, according to the UN Charter, people under occupation have the right to resist. You cannot blame.
No, I'm not saying that they don't have the right, but I'm saying
they are shelling also towns. They're not just fighting with these civilians. I mean, there is no way that they When an invasion of a country starts, the invader is the culprit. And this is what's happening. I mean, the whole calculation that people will not resist, this is their calculation. And now there are two kinds of, there are civilians who are not taking up arms, mm-hmm. but I'm sure they support people defending them.
But how do they, how does the U.S. military distinguish between the civilians that are part of the resistance and the civilians that are not armed, and how do they honor the ones that are not
armed? First of all, they shell towns.
And so they're not trying to make any distinction, you're saying?
I don't think they're trying to make any distinction. And secondly, even if they try to make a distinction, this is what I'm trying to explain. This is the absence of a discourse about an invasion. What's the meaning of an invasion? They are invading a country. The only way to avoid civilians is to withdraw. It's like the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories.
I see.
I mean, you cannot say, why are civilians taking up arms? Then we cannot do anything about it. What are you doing there in the first place? You should see what's happening in the Arab streets now. This is, there's a new discourse. The U.S. is not seen as different than Israel on the occupied territories. The U.S. embraces Israeli occupation. That's one level. Now the U.S. is the direct occupier. How is, you know, Saddam might not be there for long, but Iraqis don't want to be under occupation. And the other thing that the U.S. did not expect is for the Iraqi leadership to take the chance of an uprising against it by arming Iraqi people. Yes, maybe eventually they'll take up arms against Saddam Hussein, but I think these people want to control their destiny. They hate Saddam, but who wants to be invaded?
Are there any final thoughts on your part?
Yes. I mean, there's no victory. The U.S. can have a military victory. Nobody thinks that Iraqis can militarily defeat the U.S. And maybe they'll bring down Saddam. But what is America doing? It's occupying another country. That's what it is doing. And this is what's happening, and this is what people have to understand. This is an occupation of another country. Military victory does not bring about a political victory or a moral victory. So what? I mean, Saddam, you cannot reduce Iraq into Saddam Hussein. There are people there.
Lamisa Doni is an independent journalist who has been monitoring Arab language media and reporting on the Middle East for over two decades. In Baghdad today, the skies have begun to clear after rain yesterday. This brings relief from the smoking oil fires that have been set all around the city to obscure the vision of the attacking U.S. and British planes. Meanwhile, the U.S. is going ahead with plans for restructuring Iraq, including a no-bid contract awarded to Halliburton to put oil well fires out. Vice President Dick Cheney is the former CEO of Halliburton. Today we continue part two of an interview with Jim Vallette, the author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Used by Saddam Hussein. Vallette says he's uncovered new evidence that oil has long been the driving concern behind U.S.-Iraqi relations. Through research of memos, telegrams, and documents dating back to the Reagan administration, he discovered plans for the Bechtel Corporation to build an oil pipeline through Jordan.
The Bush-Cheney administration has steadfastly, first, they rebutted and refuted any sort of argument that this has anything to do with oil, and now they don't even mention the word oil. They avoid the word oil at all costs in terms of discussing U.S. Intervention there. Mm-hmm. Like Ari Fleischer, he was asked a question recently at a press conference about, you know, what does the U.S. really want to do with Iraq's oil? And, you know, in classic Bush speak, he never mentioned the word oil in his response, but used the word resources of Iraq many times.
Well, he said that it belongs to the Iraqi people. This is what President Bush's response has been to that question.
Well, yeah.
And yet one of the first interests that they secured were the oil wells, or the first Marine was actually killed attempting to secure the oil wells in Iraq.
Yeah.
In your report, Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein, you also say that this report reveals how the White House, through the Department of State and National Security Council, pressured the U.S. Export-Import Bank. Can you expound on that and U.S. overseas private investment corporations?
Sure. Those two are government agencies. They're taxpayer-financed. There are institutions. And the Export-Import Bank provides loans and credits for the export of U.S. equipment to projects overseas. And OPIC provides insurance, like political risk insurance. And initially, the Export-Import Bank was very reluctant to give any kind of backing to this pipeline project. They viewed Iraq as an extremely risky place to do business, but with pressure from the State Department, specifically from Lawrence Eagleburger, who is one of the prominent kind of talk show hawks of this current conflict, Eagleburger pressured EXIM to change that policy, to open its doors to financing in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And similar pressure was exerted from the National Security Council upon OPIC, and it resulted in over $500 million in preliminary financing approved by those two agencies.
If we can just look back at Bechtel, the would-be Bechtel pipeline for a moment, in as much as it did not get built, does Bechtel stand to benefit at all from the current war with Iraq, or has Halliburton basically beat them out altogether?
I don't think Halliburton's beating them out. I'm sure they'll both get plenty of business there. Yeah, we'll see how it all shakes out. But clearly what we've seen so far from the information we're getting about contracting out in the initial phases is that the spoils of war will go to U.S. companies. And I know this is now a source of tension with the U.K., but in the broader sense, the Bush-Cheney administration isn't doing anything to dispel people's fears about the true motivation of this present conflict.
What is your opinion of how Saddam fell into disfavor with this current Bush administration around this Bechtel deal that led to the point where there's this showdown between he and President Bush?
The U.S. Went out on a pretty big limb in the 1980s. Saddam and the Ba'athist Party back in 1972 nationalized the Iraq Petroleum Company, which was a consortium of British Petroleum, Exxon, Mobil, Total of France, and Shell. And after that, the diplomatic relationship between the U.S. and Iraq was severed, and the U.S. tilted itself heavily towards Iran. That tilt ended with the overthrow of Shah Pahlavi in 1979, 1980. And immediately after the Reagan administration took office in 1981, the first feelers went back into Iraq, and the State Department started opening up a dialogue, which really hit its stride when Rumsfeld met with Saddam Hussein in 1983. Over the next 2 years, the U.S. was really playing the Iraq card heavily, trying to work with Saddam Hussein on getting this very lucrative oil pipeline project. And then when Saddam rejected the deal, business relations certainly cooled. Then Saddam invaded Kuwait. And as a pretext for invading Kuwait, he accused Kuwait of being in cahoots with the United States and the United Arab Emirates in manipulating oil prices, thus being an alleged threat to Iraq's national security. So even the Kuwait conflict had a certainly a subtext, if not an overtone, of oil. Since then, these folks from the Reagan administration, the folks who crafted the current policy on Iraq, saw these big oil contracts going out to companies from other countries.
Saudi Arabia,
France, Russia, China, Brazil. I mean, this is a lot of money they see going down the drain, and with no hope of being able to make a deal with Saddam politically or logically.
Curiously, those are the countries that were opposed to this war in the U.N. Security Council.
Sure. I don't think there's much coincidence. I mean, I think it's, there's certainly some some element of that in how each country formulates its relations. And I mean, that's really the saddest and most tragic side of this is that, you know, when a dictator is a friend of a certain country, and when it signs a deal with the company's corporations, it becomes a friend. And when this dictator doesn't allow these corporations to do business, then it's a mortal enemy. And we've seen that certainly with Saddam Hussein.
Jim Vallette is the author of Crude Vision, How Oil Interests Obscured U.S. Government Focus on Chemical Weapons Use by Saddam Hussein. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.